Oh, well, so much for that stock market crash.
Never mind, never mind, never mind, never mind.
A record rise on Wall Street yesterday is being matched by markets around the world. Is it all over? Has confidence returned to the financial system? In a few moments, the president will announce a historic plan to take partial control of banks and other financial institutions. What's the word?
Never mind.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 14th. And John, that voice sounds familiar. Where'd that come from?
It's Gilda Radner dance mix. Never
there
mind.
There you go. Dance
Good morning,
mix.
Adora.
Today we'll hear from President Bush. That should be happening in just a few minutes, and he's going to be giving us some details about the Treasury Department's plans to help the banks. We're looking at the money trail in campaigns. Does it dictate which candidate wins? We'll get the answer from Freakonomics co-author Stephen Dubner. He's with us today. And an update on the power-sharing struggles in Zimbabwe. The story's coming up, but first, a few headlines.
In a few moments, the White House is expected to announce it will inject as much as $250 billion into nine of the nation's largest banks. It's the first concrete step in the government's $700 billion financial bailout. Markets in Asia and Europe have responded to all the financial levers being pulled. The Nikkei gained more than 14% today in Tokyo, its largest single-day jump. London, Paris, and Frankfurt markets have all gained around 5.5%. The Dow futures are up nearly 250 points.
Meanwhile, congressional Democrats are calling for a second economic stimulus package, this time about $150 billion. They'll say it'll be used for infrastructure, helping states, and perhaps tax rebates or cuts. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
A recovery package is needed. It may have to be larger than the one we passed in the House in light of the events that have transpired since we had our legislative action on the floor.
House Republicans are pushing their own economic aid plan that's calling for more tax cuts and energy exploration to stabilize the economy. While hundreds of firefighters work to contain two major wildfires near Los Angeles, a third one broke out yesterday further south near Camp Pendleton. Police Detective Kim Rainwater says that's an area, it's a tinderbox.
Conditions in this area are extremely dry. We've been experiencing a Santa Ana over the last 3 or 4 days with the humidity down in the teens.
All right, that was from Santa Ana, California. We now go to the White House, where the president is announcing details of the bailout plan.
Good morning. I just completed a meeting with my working group on financial markets. We discussed the unprecedented and aggressive steps the federal government is taking to address the financial crisis. Over the past few weeks, my administration has worked with both parties in Congress to pass the financial rescue plan. Federal agencies have moved decisively to shore up struggling institutions and stabilize our markets. And the United States has worked with partners around the world to coordinate our actions to get our economies back on track. This weekend, I met with finance ministers from the G7 and the G20, organizations representing some of the world's largest and fastest growing economies.
Stations, we're going to continue live with President Bush here from the White House.
To provide new liquidity, strengthen financial institutions, protect our citizen savings, and ensure fairness and integrity in the markets. Yesterday, leaders in Europe moved forward with this plan. They announced significant steps to inject capital into their financial systems by purchasing equity in major businesses.
This is The Takeaway, and we're listening to President Bush revealing details of the financial bailout that's being announced at the White House.
We will give small business owners peace of mind and bring stability to the bring greater stability to the banking system. Fourth, the Federal Reserve will soon finalize work on a new program to serve as a buyer of last resort for commercial paper. This is a key source of short-term financing for American businesses and financial institutions. And by unfreezing the market for commercial paper, the Federal Reserve will help American businesses meet payroll and purchase inventory and invest to create jobs. In a few moments, Secretary Paulson and other members of my working group on financial markets will explain these steps in greater detail. They will make clear that each of these new programs contains safeguards to protect the taxpayers. They will make clear that the government's role will be limited and temporary. And they will make clear that these measures are not intended to take over the free market, but to preserve it. The measures I have announced today are the latest steps in a systematic approach to address the crisis. I know Americans are deeply concerned about the stress in our financial markets and the impact it is having on their retirement accounts and 401ks and college savings and other investments. I recognize that the action leaders are taking here in Washington and in European capitals can seem distant from those concerns. But these efforts are designed to directly benefit the American people by stabilizing our overall financial system and helping our economy recover. It'll take time for our efforts to have their full impact, but the American people can have confidence about our long-term economic future. We have a strategy that is broad, that is flexible, and that is aimed at the root cause of our problem. Nations around the world are working together to overcome this challenge. And with confidence and determination, we will return our economies to the path of growth and prosperity. Thank you.
President Bush speaking a few moments ago at the White House, announcing plans to begin the spending from the $700 billion rescue plan that was passed 11 days ago by the Congress. And the strategy does contain some surprises. Instead of buying so-called toxic assets, the plan will directly inject capital into 9 major banks in the United States. It will take an ownership position, an equity position in those banks, with the opportunity that the Treasury will be reimbursed when that stock is resold, possibly even at a profit. The president saying that this is essential to restore confidence in the financial system, and also indicating that to explain more of the details, and the financial industry will be very interested in those details. Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, will be speaking momentarily to take questions and also provide more of the details. It's a very, very interesting 11 days that we've had.
What we heard from him this morning was what we would not have expected when they first announced this bailout and the buying of toxic assets. Interestingly enough, he also said that the Federal Reserve would be open to buying commercial paper, anything, it seems, to unfreeze the marketplace so that the lending between banks and therefore to consumers can carry on.
Well, that is the centerpiece of this program. It's a way of taking the bank industry and injecting it with capital and restarting the commercial paper market, with the idea that then that's going to flow through the economy and get things started again. I mean, we should point out that the global markets are continuing their soaring rise from yesterday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average with a historic rise. Asian markets are continuing to rise. And, of course, the Dow Jones Industrial Average futures, which were already pretty high as the president began speaking, are setting at their highs at this point at about up 202. That's the Dow Jones Industrial Average futures.
And one of his first sentences in his statement was to praise the actions by the G7 nations to shore up the markets, talking about Europe and Japan banks that have now injected their own emergency bailout plans, injected their own multi-billion dollars to help their markets.
Joining us from the New York Times is markets correspondent Vikas Bajaj. Vikas, this is interesting in its details and also very interesting in the initial market reaction. Explain, will you?
Yeah, I mean, this is to some degree what people were saying they should have done all along in the first place. Chuck Schumer, among others, were saying that there should be direct injection into capital into the banks because, in effect, the problem the banks have is the troubled assets is one thing, but that's sort of symbolic of the larger problem, which is that they don't have enough capital, and you can do it in a more easy and sort of quick way if you just give them capital. And so I think the market's sort of reflecting what seems to be a quicker and sort of more elegant solution than buying troubled assets. Although, from what I understand, Treasury still plans to buy troubled assets. They hired some people yesterday. They announced the hiring of an investment consultant to help them with that.
And they've also hired law firms to investigate what the issues are in actually taking ownership positions in some of these banks. If this was so self-evident, to you, and I'm not accusing you of being an I told you so here, but if this was so self-evident 11 days ago, what's been driving this transformation from buying toxic assets in the beginning to actually coming close to a form of nationalization here today?
I think what happened was that the credit markets froze up even further from where they were, and I think they realized, policymakers realized, that you know they needed to move more quickly than an asset purchase program would allow them to do. I mean, you have to set up a bureaucracy, you have to hire advisors and managers, and all of that takes time, and the markets essentially didn't give the administration much time to get it off the ground.
And do you think that the administration just fundamentally miscalculated the extent of this problem?
I don't know about that per se. I think in the last few weeks or months, they've been pretty clear that they think this is a serious issue. I guess one could go back further, and a lot of people have done and said that, you know, earlier in the year and last year, the administration appeared to respond more slowly than a lot of people would have liked, and that perhaps, you know, if we had gone ahead of this problem earlier in the year, we might have been in a better position.
Because it's expected that this decision this morning is going to directly affect Citigroup, Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, and possibly even Goldman Sachs. How do those institutions change as of what's been announced today?
I don't. For some of them, there won't be a lot of change. And from what me and my colleagues were hearing yesterday, some of these institutions actually did not want this capital. They were essentially told that, you know, this is not voluntary. We would like you to take this money. In part, this is done because they wanted to make not to have sort of any stigma attached to this, so that you know, if you gave capital to one bank but not to another, maybe that suggests that the bank that got the capital was in more trouble than the bank that didn't get the capital. And so that's why they've done this across the board. And I don't think there will be direct changes. At least we don't know yet what direct changes there will be.
Well, one of our guests earlier this morning, Peter Morisi, who is very, very passionate on the issue of management control and management that got some of these institutions into this mess, says that the government is very much weak-kneed on the question of directing bank managers to actually make very, very different decisions on compensation and on all kinds of strategic questions, and that the Treasury is pretty much giving these bank managers a free hand. Is that your view?
I think that's certainly the view of critics. Critics will take that this is, in that sense, not very different from what Britain did, for instance, where you know they effectively took control of the Royal Bank of Scotland and they got rid of the management. They wiped out a lot of the control that their existing shareholders had, and this is very different in that regard. It doesn't take control, doesn't even give them a board seat. From what I understand, it's a fairly small dividend that the banks will be paying. And so, yeah, in that sense, it's not the kind of thing that a lot of people have said that they need to do in addition to providing the capital.
Last question, because the FDIC is going to temporarily extend its coverage to cover most new debt. What does that mean?
What that means, my understanding is that is really aimed at small businesses. What they've been noticing is that small businesses have been moving their money, their sort of cash on hand, from smaller banks to perhaps bigger banks that they believe have a more sound business. And, you know, they're worried about that. They're worried that smaller institutions that perhaps could have been, in danger would be in more danger because these institutions, these companies are moving their money. And so it's meant to sort of shore up confidence. That they're trying to be careful in how they do it, in the sense that they're only doing it for non-interest-bearing accounts as opposed to savings accounts, so that they don't cause people to move lots of their savings from one place to another.
Well, it's a historic step, the FDIC essentially guaranteeing one sector of the commercial paper market. Vikas Bajaj, New York Times correspondent, thanks so much for joining us from Washington. Commenting on the president's live announcement within the last 10 minutes of the bailout plan.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I am almost of retirement age. All my retirement is in the stock market, pretty much. And I don't fear anything. I believe in the American economy. I haven't touched anything. I'm going to ride it through. I think that's the patriotic thing to do.
So what about you? Are you retired? Are you planning on retiring? Do you have parents or grandparents or loved ones who are retiring? What are they most worried about? What steps have you taken to assure your economic future? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And the polls are open. There are early voting laws in states all around the nation, and we are America's exit poll. We're asking people about the moment they made up their mind. If you have voted, be a part of our exit poll. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're America's exit poll. And now,
freak out. Ooh, Freakonomics.
It's time for Stephen Dubner. He's joined us in the studio, co-author of the Freakonomics book and blog. And what he's looking at this morning is the question of, or the correlation of, money and politics. If you have more and spend more, does it mean you're more likely to win? Stephen, what do you think?
I mean, no.
That seems obvious.
No.
No?
You want the long answer or the short answer? Short answer is no. The long answer is that the candidate with more money does usually win. But our point is this. It's not the money that wins the election. It's the fact that the candidate is appealing and therefore attracts more money. In other words, the money is far, far less powerful. And I can walk you through the proof of how we arrived at this conclusion. I'll be honest with you. Most people don't believe us.
I was going to say, because I'd be one of those people. Because even if you're likable, you need money to introduce yourself to voters that you cannot go up and shake hands and have a long discussion
this
with.
This is true. And this is why this is a really hard topic to figure out. But it's worth figuring out, right?
But it's a wag the dog thing. Let me just get it straight again. You're not saying that money doesn't help. You're just saying that money follows the candidate. Money is a sign of a winner. It's not a determinant of a winner.
People want to give money to the candidate who is more appealing, right? Hmm. So, you know, this is an interesting quote from Jim Jordan, who advised Kerry in the 2004 campaign. This is from a piece in the Chicago Tribune not long ago talking about Obama's unbelievable fundraising prowess. He said, "Money is not dispositive, but I would rather outspend my opponent 4-1 than be outspent 4-1. That's about right. Money is not the thing that makes it happen. But would you rather have more money or less? You'd rather have more, certainly. But what we try to do is try to determine the effect of money. And the way that we did this was based on a paper that my Freakonomics co-author Steve Levitt did years ago, which was extremely clever. These things are hard to measure. How do you know? So anybody that wants to make an argument on either side can find an anecdote, right? That's what we usually do in this world. We find an anecdote that illustrates our opinion.
Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of those on the presidential level.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, right. The presidential thing is under such a lens. But so you could make all kinds of arguments for right now Obama, you know, has spent so much more money on media, more than double the money on media that McCain has spent, okay? So you could say, well, if he wins, it's because he spent so much more, for instance, on media. But then on the other hand, I can look at all the people like Tom Golisano, who ran for governor of New York State three times.
Rich guy.
Spent millions upon millions upon millions of dollars for over the course of three elections combined. He got about 30% of the vote. Okay, so where is the money making the people vote for you? It doesn't happen. The paper that Levitt did, if you give me 30 seconds, I'll try to explain it. It's a little bit dull,
but I'll try to make it
less dull. Here's the problem. When you try to measure the impact of money, how do you divorce the money from the candidate, him or herself? It's hard. So what he did is he took instances in legislative races in which two candidates ran against each other multiple times. Mm. So you've got the same candidate. So it's kind of like a little randomized control trial where you've got rat A and rat B and one's getting saccharin and the other is not, right? And try to measure the effect of the money when there's different amounts of money spent. And he found that money was accountable for maybe about – you could spend 1% more money – excuse me. You could double your spending and only get about 1% more of the vote.
Freakonomics.
Wow. That's pretty good.
And similarly, you could spend less money and only get a lot less money and only get a little bit less of the vote.
It's a pretty surprising result.
Which leads us to believe that the arrow in our minds is traveling in the wrong way. It's not the money that make people vote. It's the attractiveness that raises the money, that attracts the money.
What about in congressional races, the power of incumbency?
Yep.
Does money have anything to do with breaking that down?
Excellent question. So incumbency is a very powerful driver, far more than money in and of itself. So you have to control for that when you're talking about these legislative races. The short answer is incumbency is great. But really what incumbency is really a little bit more – incumbency is a little bit more like the kid who goes to a really good high school then gets into a really good college. It's not that surprising. The reason they bumped up to the level was because they were attractive in the first place. Incumbency is an indicator of how attractive you are in the first place, but also there are advantages.
So – and you could equate that in some ways to just name recognition, right? If someone is liked in some – recognizable way and they run for office, and we can certainly think of a couple of examples of that, then they win.
Right. Yeah, I hate to be reductive, especially on a show like this that's not reductive, and with an audience like yours it is not reductive, but when we vote, it's a little bit like people pressing a button that determines the Q rating on a TV personality. Do we like the person? How much do we like the person, okay? And we kind of all know that deep down, as much as we want to think it's about something deeper and more variegated in that, but we really only have one of two buttons to press typically, and it's the liking the person that attracts the money in the first place. So people want to give to the winner. They want to feel good about who they're giving to.
He's going to stay with us, Freakonomics author and our pal Stephen Dubner, addressing his comments to the reductive members of our audience.
Apologizing before he said we're all simpletons and it is a big popularity contest when it comes to elections.
We embrace the reductive in our audience, and occasionally we are reductive around here. And reduce us to tears, Femi, okay, with the latest headlines.
Hello there, John. I'll try not to. It is coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. President Bush just announced plans for the first chunk of the bailout plan, and the government will buy $250 billion worth of equity shares in banks. But the president did emphasize that this was part of a global process.
Nations around the world are working together to overcome this challenge. And with confidence and determination, we will return our economies to the path of growth and prosperity.
The president in his speech this morning also said that the FDIC will expand insurance cover for accounts that aid small businesses. Santa Ana winds are fueling the huge wildfires near Los Angeles. The blaze has forced thousands to flee their homes. California's Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared a state of emergency. A U.S.-led coalition killed five militants in central Afghanistan today. One of its own members also died in a separate roadside bomb explosion. Boeing says its latest round of talks with the machinist union has failed. The company's factories have been closed since 27,000 workers walked out early last month. Canada will elect a new parliament today and possibly a new prime minister. The current prime minister, Stephen Harper, called the election with the intent of reaching a majority in parliament. But the financial crisis has driven his popularity way down. And that's a look at some of the main stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Not even 30 minutes ago, President Bush laid out some of the details of the $250 billion infusion into the banking system. And while the Bush administration and his team works on fixing the banking system and thereby helping the struggling economy, the presidential candidates are thinking about ways to get to voters who are worried about the economy, especially the most reliable voters like senior citizens. Republican John McCain announced a proposal that would get rid of a rule that forces senior citizens to pull money out of their IRAs or 401ks when they get to 70 and a half years old. Democrat Barack Obama followed suit, and he's also backed the idea. Still with us in this conversation is Stephen Dubner, co-author of Freakonomics, the book and blog, and also joining us is certified financial planner Angela Thompson with Coastal Financial Planning. Good morning, Angela.
Good morning.
And we have a question for you from one of our listeners.
Okay.
What scares me is that I don't need my money right this minute, and if I was a retiree, what would I do? But I don't know what to do for the future. What if I did need it right now?
Angela, what's your thought?
If she does, well, first of all, as CFPs, we're big advocates of planning. So if she does need it right now, she should start with budgeting. I mean, she needs to take a good look at how she's spending her money and create a budget plan for herself. And if she does have immediate needs, she needs to keep it in a safe harbor, someplace that doesn't have a lot of volatility so she can have immediate access to her money.
Oh, gee. Wow. What's a safe harbor these days?
A safe harbor would be a money market with a low yield that has a checking account attached to it, so mm-hmm. that if she has an emergency, she can write a check against it.
Well, Angela, these are certainly tough times, and when you hear numbers like millions and billions lost in the marketplaces, what are your clients saying? What are they most worried about?
They are really worried about the retirement, particularly my clients in their mid-50s that had a goal of retirement at 62 or 65. We have seen volatility in all the portfolios. Almost every portfolio has turned in a negative number. And even though we had a great rally yesterday, it hasn't made up for all the losses. So they're very focused on where the future is going to, when are we going to see a return on our investment, and how long will it take for the market to stabilize? And, you know, as planners, what we do is right now we're looking at stocks that have dividend yield.
Mm-hmm.
So that dividend yield might make up some of the losses right now. Every client that does retirement planning has a long-term retirement plan in place. So they're coming in right now. We're looking at their retirement plans.
Those who are actually retired? Now, let's just think about the Republican John McCain and Barack Obama's idea of getting rid of that rule that forces those who are 70, exactly, the 70-and-a-half-year-olds to pull out money from their IRAs or 401ks. Would that make any difference?
It would and it wouldn't. Some people really need that distribution. So if you need that distribution, to take that rule away is futile. I mean, if you need that money, what difference does that rule, taking that rule away, make? Okay. Now, there are other clients that really don't need that distribution right now, and it would be beneficial to leave that money intact and have it accrue and compound over time, so that when they did reach a time when they needed it, maybe at 80, they would be more likely to need that money. It would be sitting in the market, and it would rebound and, you know, hopefully get back to where it was over time.
Angela, Angela, this is Stephen Dubner. I have a question for you, which is this. A lot has been made of retirees being misallocated, having too much in equities, or people who are near retirement having too much in equities and taking too much of a hit right now. However, when people are already retired and do start to draw down, what kind of allocation do you want? What kind of equity participation do you want for people who are already retired? Because you don't want to be missing the market entirely, correct, in equities?
That's correct. But you know what? It's not exactly what I want. It's what the client wants. It's what the client's risk tolerance is. I have clients that are 100% in equities, and I will tell you, the older the client is, the more exposure they want in equities. And I agree with that. Equities are 100% transparent. Mutual funds have not performed well over this year, particularly. And with equities, you know what you're buying. Now, you always have you know, I hate to go back to B.S. Stearns, but if you looked at B.S. Stearns' book value and you looked at them collapsing, you really couldn't, it wasn't transparent as it should have been. But historically, stocks are very transparent, and I would almost always take a stock over a mutual fund across the board. Now, obviously, they want bond exposure, but over time, I really would almost always take an equity position.
So you're saying you've got retirees who are 100, you've got people who are retired who are 100% in stocks.
Yes,
and,
I do.
And you don't smack them upside the head for that? That doesn't
And you know what? I have a client who's 102. Ew. And she is 100% in equities.
What does she have to lose, you know? I mean, it's like, what's the big deal?
She lives at home. She has full-time assistance. I had another client who passed away 2 years ago, a month before she turned 102, in 100% equities. These people have literally lived through the Depression, remember the Depression, and do not like mutual funds because they don't know what's in there.
But that sounds like you're dealing with someone there who is fine for their living expenses for the rest of their life and is really just thinking about passing on something that's strong as opposed to drawing down gradually, yes?
Yes, but you have to realize how they made their money is being in 100% equities. They didn't make their money in mutual funds. They made their money in equities.
I got to think she's an outlier, and
that's
I would just
great.
Say, as a non-CFP, I hereby declare that for most retirees, do not be 100% in equities,
right.
Please.
I totally understand your point, and exactly, that's not how—
Angela, don't let him push you around. just because he wrote this Freakonomics book doesn't mean he's allowed to push you around.
But it does sound, though, Angela, that it really would depend on how much money you have at retirement.
Right. These clients clearly are not sitting in $100,000 portfolios. All right, you know, let's put that on the table right now.
Right. These are people who have a lot of money and can really weather the losses.
You know, and I'll be very honest with you. One of these clients is sitting in Citigroup, and I have tried to get her out of that. Actually, I'm dealing with her daughter at this point. At 102, she's not mobile. And I've tried. This was well before the year began, okay?
Right.
You know, I really think you need to divest this. And they wouldn't divest themselves of that. Yeah. And her position was, my parents have had this forever, and I'm not dismantling the portfolio.
Yeah, sounds like
okay?
a sitcom.
I know. There's
like
a lot of stories out there. And Angela Thompson, we thank you so much for bringing us a few of them.
All right.
Angela Thompson is a certified financial planner for Coastal Financial Planning in Lincoln, Rhode Island. An interesting perspective because so many other financial planners will say don't put everything into
That's
equities,
right.
no matter how old you are.
Interesting client base she has. Well, the polls are open and we are America's exit poll. If you have voted in some of the early voting states, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org and tell us the story of how you made up your mind. Remember, we're America's exit poll.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. The supposedly historic power-sharing government in Zimbabwe is not projecting much power today, and it's not showing much signs of sharing either. Thabo Mbeki, South Africa's former president, brokered the deal, but now the so-called agreement between Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai seems to be falling apart. Joining us now is Jonah Fisher, BBC correspondent in Johannesburg, and that's where he's reaching us from. Jonah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Now, this is an argument over ministries, whether they go to ZANU-PF, Mugabe's party, or to Tsvangirai's party, but it really seems to project that these two individuals, despite the agreement, are fundamentally incompatible. Give us the details.
Well, under the terms of the agreement that was signed about 4 weeks ago, the ministries were divided, 16 ministries to the opposition Movement for Democratic Change factions and 15 ministries to Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF. But crucially, what wasn't specified in that agreement was exactly what ministries they'd be. And for the last 4 weeks, there have been deadlock discussions between ZANU-PF and the MDC as they tried to decide who would get what. on Saturday, Robert Mugabe decided to take matters into his own hands and simply announced who would get what. And surprise, surprise, he allocated himself all of the key ministries: defence, home affairs, foreign affairs, transport, provisionally finance as well, leaving the opposition with ministries such as health and education. Important ministries, but not ones which carry the real clout in terms of security in Zimbabwe. So the opposition are now saying, well, if that's your idea of power sharing, to us that looks like a power grab, and we will not take part in a government on those terms. And that's why Thabo Mbeki's in Harare at the moment, to try and see if he can somehow save this agreement that he worked so hard to achieve in the first place.
On one level, Robert Mugabe doing this is not a surprise, but I'm wondering if Mugabe's hands are tied in some respect, that ZANU-PF knows that Mugabe is out because of his age at some point, and that Mugabe really has to leave that party with some sort of power base going forward.
Well, there's no doubt that ZANU-PF isn't just the Robert Mugabe party. It has different factions within it, and factions who certainly aren't happy with the power sharing and agreement. And I think in the 4 weeks since the signing of the agreement, they've really flexed their muscles, because those are the people who hold ministerial positions, who perhaps have senior governmental roles across Zimbabwe. And they've just woken up to the fact that under the terms of this power sharing agreement, some of their jobs will go. They'll find themselves out on a limb, and perhaps they won't be protected in the future by any immunities agreement. So, yes, certainly Robert Mugabe, I think, has felt the force of his own party and in a sense has been pulled by people with his own party into line, and that's part of the reason why we saw him trying to ensure that his party retained such a heavy influence in cabinet.
Well, Jonah Fisher on the line with us from Johannesburg, BBC correspondent in Johannesburg. The big question mark, of course, is Thabo Mbeki, no longer president of South Africa, is brokering this deal. Really unclear whether he's going to have the clout to actually bring another deal into fruition. Jonah, thanks so much for being with us. So, talk about Freakonomics in Zimbabwe.
Exactly. It really is really troubling when you have extraordinary inflation and people are at the point where they're not buying anything. They're actually just bartering with one another.
I'm surprised there's not more pressure on these leaders to make a deal and to move forward, but apparently not.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 14th. Femi Okeh has just joined us. She's got the latest headlines of the hour. Femi?
Thanks, Adora. It's just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Bush announced plans for distribution of the first chunk of the bailout plan. The government will buy $250 billion worth of equity shares in banks. Meanwhile, congressional Democrats are calling for a second economic stimulus package. Congress will hold hearings over the course of the next month to determine the exact amount. House Minority Leader John Boehner says that Republicans are coming up with their own plan. GM says it will close two more plants by the end of next year. That means that 2,700 jobs will be wiped out. GM shares lost nearly half their value last week. And gay couples from in and around California are hurrying to marry ahead of Election Day. They're worried about a proposed amendment to the state's constitution that would limit marriage to a man and a woman. Public opinion polls indicate that the measure's been gaining support in recent weeks. And that's a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
Hey, thanks. This week, voters in Pennsylvania should be feeling pretty special. Both presidential candidates and their vice presidential running mates will be spending time there, given that polls are very tight. Although national polls show to be giving Barack Obama a bit of an edge, but the McCain campaign says its internal polls show that the race is far closer. Are there that many undecided voters in Pennsylvania? Well, Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein just returned from Pennsylvania. She's got a report, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Andrea. Nice to see you.
Good morning. Nice to see you, too.
So what'd you find in Pennsylvania?
So clearly the Barack Obama campaign is concerned about the level of undecided voters in Pennsylvania, and they're sending out Hillary Clinton herself to get the Hillary Clinton voters, the undecided voters. And I was with her Sunday in northeastern Pennsylvania, and then yesterday I was with her in northeastern Philadelphia in a Jewish senior center. And just to set it up, if you look at the electoral map from 2004, what you'll find is Philadelphia deep indigo for John Kerry. The rest of the state, red or pink pretty much, except for a little light blue around Pittsburgh and a few sort of colorless-ish counties. but mostly Philadelphia is how John Kerry won the race, and Obama knows he has to do that. And he has to do it not only by getting a big African-American vote, a big young vote, a big urban professional vote, by also winning some of these voters in northeastern Pennsylvania that Hillary Clinton was speaking to. And she went in there yesterday. Remember, we heard yesterday morning her talking in West Virginia with that little bit of twang. So yesterday she was speaking to the seniors, and we heard all about how Obama was indeed a friend to Israel, and that the Republicans want to do with health care what they did with Wall Street, too many booze.
It's a very different twang there at the Jewish Community Center in North Philly.
A very different twang. But then afterwards, I went and I talked to a lot of the voters, and they were still not sold, like this voter, Audrey Beetham. And I want to say that she mispronounces Obama's name, but what she says is quite rational, so don't get caught up in that.
Don't forget, she told us, you know, all different things and not to vote for Obama. And she pointed all things against Obama, which she really did. She really did. And she had a lot more things to say about Obama. She really did. And I guess they're still in the back of my mind, so I'm not sure.
Obama, you could have corrected her there.
You know, I didn't want to make her feel self-conscious. I wanted to let her finish the thought, which is an interesting thought because, you know, I said to people, well, Hillary Clinton says Obama and I are essentially the same. So here is a woman saying, well, that's not what she spent 6 months telling us. And, you know, this was a Democratic crowd. I mean, there were some Republicans there. I met a couple of women who said, we became Democrat when we opened up our 401k statements last week.
Wow.
But next to the auditorium where Clinton was speaking, now, I should say, I mean, she got a standing ovation, which is something in a senior center because people are standing up on their canes and their walkers and, you know, big, big, big cheers. And yet, when I went and I spoke to some of the people having lunch of macaroni and cheese and stewed tomatoes, they were not decided at all. And these two women, Sandy and Esther, and you'll hear Sandy first, these are two Democrats.
He's very friendly with Farrakhan is his name, and he was such a Jew hater. So I, that's why I'm giving it thought.
I'd heard they weren't friends. You don't believe that?
I didn't see. I saw the write-up that they were friends. I don't know.
A lot of things are propaganda, but it wasn't propaganda when he was sitting there and the priest was saying, God damn America. How do you say it's a wonderful country?
So when Hillary Clinton says, well, the country's in a mess, so you should...
It is a mess. I know it is.
You don't blame the Republicans?
Yeah, sure I do.
We do. Yeah, absolutely. I blame them.
And yet you're thinking about not voting Democrat.
Well, I'm giving it thought.
Now, are these all strongholds, I'm assuming, of Hillary Clinton's? These were the communities that voted strongly for her in the primary.
Yeah, almost everybody that I spoke with in this senior center. And, you know, these undecided were not random people that I found. I mean, there were supporters of Obama. There were supporters of McCain. But they just heard this big, strong, you know, standing room
she
only.
She didn't convince them, it sounds
she
like.
She didn't convince
Hillary
them.
Hillary Clinton wasn't
and
able
they
to
had
really...
voted for her in the primary. And, of course, a lot of people voted for her in the Pennsylvania primary. She won by a pretty healthy margin.
But can I just ask one really dumb question? I mean, is it possible that Pennsylvania is so close that it's going to come down to Sandy and Esther?
You know, anything is possible. I mean, the fact that Obama and Biden were just there and McCain and Palin are going to be there today, McCain's going to be in the suburbs of Philadelphia, Palin's going to be right back where I was in Scranton. I mean, they think that these voters are persuadable or turnable. And I did hear a voter, and we can actually, I mean, I think one of the questions about is, you know, is sort of this charge of terrorism getting through. I did hear a McCain supporter, and she was pretty clear on what she thinks that her campaign has been telling her.
Because he doesn't have a Reverend Wright in his background, and he doesn't have, who are the terrorists? Bill and what's her name? You know, in the background, and he is to be admired, and I trust in him as opposed to Barack Obama.
She's referring to McCain. She trusts him over Barack Obama.
Right, she is, and clearly this is what the McCain campaign is hoping that this sort of, you know, strategy that it has been sort of trying to play out over the last few weeks of mentioning Bill Ayers and raising it is going to do, which is get these people who are not decided to either not vote or to vote for McCain.
But did you sense any real enthusiasm? Even in that, there seems to be a bit of a hesitancy. And at the end of the day, Pennsylvania is really important in such a tight election when you're talking about 21 electoral votes.
Yeah. And it's a must win for McCain. There's almost no scenario, given the advantage that Obama has in some states like Iowa and Virginia that Bush won, there is almost no scenario in which McCain can win without Pennsylvania. So he really needs to win it. And, you know, I'm going and looking for undecided voters. And the voter we just heard, Gloria LaSalva, said, why are you spending more time talking to Audrey than to me? And I said, well, I'm trying to figure out, you know, what's going to make an undecided voter vote. So, you know, I'm skewing my sample a little bit. I mean, clearly there are partisans. And I went to a rally out in the suburbs with Hillary Clinton, and there were lots of people saying the things you'd expect to hear. You know, Obama gives us so much hope. And I'm going to go hear Sarah Palin today, and I imagine I'll find some enthusiasm. So it's not like there's no enthusiasm.
But it's been really interesting listening to the tape and hearing how these people are making up their minds or not. I mean, that, I think, is what's
right.
been fascinating.
And I was surprised because, you know, I was in Pennsylvania about 3 weeks ago, and I thought, as I've seen in some of the other states, that there would be a bigger tipping by now. And there were. There were people who had made up their minds. But the fact that there were so many people that are still undecided with just one debate and 3 weeks left to go was surprising to me.
Where is Clinton being deployed next, do we know?
She is going to Virginia. She's going to Ohio. I think she's done with Pennsylvania for now. But clearly she's being sent to all of the areas of the big undecideds where it's not an easy sell. I mean, if these people are holding out, it's not an easy sell.
They're sending my mother-in-law to Tallahassee, Florida. That's a Republican stronghold. So it's interesting, this strategy. Well, thanks so much, Andrea.
Thank you.
Andrea Bernstein, our political director, and with us all hour, the inimitable Stephen Dubner. Thanks to you. And we got to go.
We do, but want to remind you, we're always on at the Takeaway.
The polls are open. We're conducting America's exit poll. People are voting in this election in states who have early voting laws. And what we really want to know from you, if you voted, when did you make up your mind and what decided it for you? Tell us the story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And here's a takeaway to consider.
This is, to some degree, what people were saying they should have done all along in the first place.
That's the New York Times' Vikas Bajaj talking about the new plan that Bush announced a little under an hour ago.
We're buying banks, of course, and we're talking about money all morning. The candidates say they have big plans to help retirees out. But whether you're retiring or have parents, grandparents, or loved ones who are approaching that age, what concerns you most about this economy? What scares you most about growing old? You know how to reach us.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry. Remember, this is America's Exit Poll. The polls are open. There's early voting all over America. We want to hear from you.
And I always like when you ask, at what moment did you make your decision? Do you remember where you were and exactly what pushed you over to McCain or what pushed you over to Barack Obama or to any of the candidates you're voting for? 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm Adora Udoji.
I'm John Hockenberry. Your Ron Paul moment on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
The economic story remains the same.
The America of Hoover prosperity, of electric refrigerators, modern plumbing, and six-tube Petrodyne radio sets. The America of a new economy, an economy of perpetual prosperity, ideally expressed by its president, Hoover.
Two cars in every garage and a chicken in every pot.
The story of the latest financial crisis is a long tale of government retreat from financial oversight and continued deregulation. It's not a new story, even if we've moved beyond the chickens and the pots. But thank goodness for those radio sets. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's October 14th. It's Tuesday, and perpetual prosperity. That has a nice ring to it, doesn't it, John?
Yes. Bring back President Hoover. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning. Today, more on the Treasury Department's plan to inject $250 billion into the banking system following on the heels of European banks. A pollster helps us make sense of what the voters are saying, and a story about a banjo player and a brain surgeon. The story does have a happy ending. It's coming up, but first these headlines.
About an hour ago, President Bush pulled the trigger, announcing specific steps for spending the $700 billion bailout. He called for a direct cash infusion into nine of the nation's largest banks, whether they like it or not. And he says the FDIC will broaden its guarantees and the Fed will become, quote, a buyer of last resort for commercial paper, a key source of short-term financing for American businesses and financial institutions. Still, even with these concrete actions, the president urged patience.
It'll take time for our efforts to have their full impact, but the American people can have confidence about our long-term economic future. We have a strategy that is broad, that is flexible, and that is aimed at the root cause of our problem.
Markets are continuing something of a celebration around the world. The Dow futures are up nearly 400 points, a positive open in less than a half hour.
Meanwhile, congressional Democrats are calling for a second economic stimulus package, this time for about $150 billion, which they see is needed for infrastructure, helping states, and perhaps giving people tax rebates. Here's Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
We have to tighten our belt, take ourselves into survival mode as we see the challenges to the economy of our country, and make some very strong decisions about our spending priorities.
House Republicans are pushing their own economic aid plan. Theirs calls for more tax cuts and energy exploration to stabilize the economy.
Priorities at GM. It's announced it's closing two of its plants by the end of the year, a plant in Janesville, Wisconsin, and a metal plant in Grand Rapids, Michigan. In baseball overnight, the Phillies are within one game of winning the National League Championship Series. They beat the Dodgers 7-5, and in the ALCS, Tampa Bay beat the Red Sox to take a 2-1 lead. And oil's at $83 a barrel. Yeah, it's baseball could be the Rays versus the Phillies. The ratings people in baseball aren't going to be thrilled with that, but it's going to be a great series.
Go
either
Joe
way,
Torre.
It's going
to
be.
Put my 2 cents. Let's anyhow, see. We're talking about money today. Are you retired? Are you planning on retiring? And how are you taking all of this economic news? Do you have a new plan? What concerns you most? 877-8 my take, or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Joe Torre may be retiring. He should call us. 877-8 my take.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I know Americans are deeply concerned about the stress in our financial markets and the impact it is having on their retirement accounts and 401ks and college savings and other investments. I recognize that the action leaders are taking here in Washington and in European capitals can seem distant from those concerns. But these efforts are designed to directly benefit the American people.
That is President Bush speaking just about an hour ago, announcing a $250 billion plan by the government to directly buy shares in the nation's leading banks and working in coordination, direct lockstep coordination with European banks and banks around the world. Not intended to take over the free market, the president said, but to preserve it. And elaborating on that plan, Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson has announced that there will be specific steps developed to buy so-called toxic and difficult assets that the banks hold on their portfolios, and also steps will be taken specifically to limit compensation on the part of people who remain managing the banks that the president has announced today the federal government will take a direct financial interest in. Joining us now is Peter Morici, who's a business and economics professor at the University of Maryland and has been our partner in covering the details as the federal government's plans for the so-called rescue package have been revealed. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Do you have any sort of optimistic sort of solace in what Hank Paulson said about limiting compensation, that there are going to be some kind of management oversight provisions to this plan?
Well, no, given how much he resisted that as we went through the process of approving the bailout bill and how limp the provisions are in the bill, even when equity participation is provided, I'm not at all optimistic. I want to see the details. What makes me even more pessimistic is the supporting essay this morning in the Wall Street Journal from Chuck Schumer. He notes that the banks should not be permitted to hoard these monies or use them for exotic financial activities. And I praise him for finally saying that, for the Senate finally saying, gee whiz, you know, these banks aren't using the money we're giving them. But there really is no specifics about executive compensation. If they're going to rely on the requirements of the legislation, all I can tell your listeners is that ain't much.
Well, let's talk about the FDIC provision, which is the other pretty historic thing that the president announced. It appears that the FDIC is being extended for some temporary period into the a sector of the commercial paper market that involves small businesses. Did you grasp the details of what he was saying there?
Well, I think that what they're talking about here is that they're going to essentially guarantee interbank transactions. And they needed some sort of cover to do that. You know, the government just can't do that. It's got to have some sort of legislation. And there's two handy places that I know of to do that. One is in the FDIC legislation, which gives it broad ability to intervene if there's systemic risk. And I don't think anyone would disagree on from any place that we are in, have systemic risk. The other would be the general oversight responsibilities of the Federal Reserve. But the Federal Reserve historically has not been in the business of guaranteeing transactions. It's only been in the business of lending money out. It's already become a private bank by going into the commercial paper business. It's buying up commercial paper right now on the open market in an effort to provide availability of funds in the to small businesses. I didn't find it particularly remarkable. What I find remarkable is how limited our approach has been compared to the Europeans. But, you know, I think we're taking the more prudent course in terms of the way we're injecting equity and the way we're guaranteeing private transactions, trying to avoid blanket coverage wherever we can.
And, Peter, let's talk about the scale of this intervention. Clearly, we are in uncharted waters. Could you be more specific about what the difference is between what the U.S. is doing today and what the European banks are doing today?
You got to remember, the U.K. is about one-tenth our size as an economy, but the financial sector is much more important to the United Kingdom than the financial sector is to the United States. It is their major export industry. You're looking at the semiconductor industry over there when you talk about banking. It's 10% of the British economy, and they are nationalizing banks. They're buying common shares, not preferred shares, and they're buying controlling interests in four large banks. That is a major takeover of financial institutions over there. It's what you'd expect from a Labour government. They have been dying to get rid of their recent legacy of New Labour over there. The Labour folks that are in control right now are dying to get back to the 1950s, and now they're there. You know, and unfortunately, they made a real hash of nationalizing steel and coal in those days. And what happens is, when you nationalize industries, they become politicized. They become methods for creating employment, and you can't run them properly. And so I'm not very optimistic about what they're doing. I think we are taking a more prudent posture. The U.S. banks haven't had a liquidity problem since last January, because the Fed's been giving them all the liquidity they want. But they've had a solvency problem. We haven't been willing to admit it, that the CEOs of our major banks, I'm not going to mention his name, have driven our banks to insolvency. And we just haven't acknowledged it, close enough to insolvency that they're not a good risk even to each other. By putting capital in this way, we've done the first right thing. The second right thing would be to address how they got into this mess. And that, frankly, is hauling these CEOs into the president's office and congratulating them on their $1 million a year salaries.
Well, not likely to happen in Washington, but we're going to add a voice to this conversation here. Hold on there, Peter. Adora?
We have Chrystia Friedland, who is the managing editor of the Financial Times and a friend of ours. So welcome back.
Hi, Adora. Nice to be with you.
So what do you make of what we've been hearing of the details this morning? I understand you think it's a bit radical what the Treasury Department's taking on.
I do, but I think it's radical in a good way. I mean, I agree with Peter that what has finally happened is we're seeing action on the solvency side rather than liquidity side. But this is a really big deal, what is happening. This is a partial nationalization of the biggest banks in the United States. I think it's necessary because the banking system is in so much trouble. They need that government money. And this is a much more effective way of putting that government money to work.
Well, let's hope that the banking system is in better shape than your cell line at that moment, Christian. Hold on there. Peter Morici, what is the inflationary threat from this plan if it persists? And basically, the government has to print money to cover all these obligations.
It does not have to print money, sir. It does not have to print money. What it's going to do is sell U.S. Treasury securities and get money from the private market and then take that money and put it into the banks. What's more, you only have an inflationary problem if you're creating liquidity that gets out into the system in the form of loans, and our problem hasn't been too much liquidity. It has been too little that the banks aren't making loans. Zip, nada, zilch, the Nell set. That is the inflationary consequences of this.
Well,
that
wait a minute, Peter. Paul Krugman, Ken Livingston says that what's going on here is that the Chinese are financing this entire program here, and that basically we've mortgaged the U.S. economy to the Chinese, and we're going to have to sort of see how it works out.
That's a different question, sir. You're conflating issues.
Okay.
I never denied it. No, we are. The basic problem, we are in this mess. One of the two reasons we're in this mess, one reason is the profligate behavior of the New York banks, their terrible behavior. The other is that we've been running this huge trade deficit thanks to Chinese currency market intervention. What they have been doing is buying dollars and selling yen to keep the yuan, very cheap and get huge amounts of exports that their comparative advantage does not require. They turn around and take those dollars and buy treasury securities. Those dollars are already out there. It's just a matter of how they're going to be used. This does not add new dollars to the system. We need to address that problem.
Okay.
But we need to address that problem. But what we're doing here neither addresses nor exacerbates that problem.
All right, Peter,
it's
maybe
just a matter of how those dollars are used.
Right. But maybe I'm an idiot. Okay. If you take out a mortgage, all right, on something, and you go way, way into debt to do it, and suddenly the value of your house declines, your cost of living goes up. That's inflation. That's essentially what we've done here. We've taken out an enormous mortgage, and the dollar begins to decline in value. That's inflation.
You have to go to the gas station and ask me if you see it at the pump price. So you have to go to the Walmart and ask me if you see it in the cost of a coffee maker. That's inflation, sir. You asked me specifically about this equity infusion. I will explain again how we will do it. It's the same way we would have taken bad paper off the books. There's a certain number of dollars out there already. Whether or not we implement this program, they are out there. We're going to sell Treasury securities and inhale some of those dollars. We're going to take them back, and then we're going to give them to the banks in exchange for equity.
Well, it seems to be
working. Dollars are being moved around.
All right, I understand, but it seems to be giving the markets a bit of a pleasure here. They're up around the world.
Have confidence that now the banks are going to become solvent again. That's why it's giving them pleasure. It is a bad thing that we are financing this huge trade deficit by borrowing from the Chinese.
But for the short term, it's all about confidence. Peter, I love talking to you, but we got to go. Peter Morici, thanks so much for being with us.
Take care.
Peter Morici, business and economics professor at the University of Maryland, explaining it all to you and me.
He's always a feisty contributor.
I love Peter.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's safe to say, and we all know, that the space program around the world has grown up. It's also chilled out a bit from its Cold War days when it was all about tension between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Today, the Soyuz Russian spacecraft is docked with the International Space Station. There's an American space tourist on board. And with the American space shuttle a little long in the tooth and due to retire in 2010, we decided we'd take a look at the space station, which it turns out is very Russian-based. The entire space program, in fact, is going to be based in Russia for about 5 years. John Schwartz, reporter for The New York Times, author of an article today in The Science Times, in Russia, a second home for U.S. astronauts. So John, it's an all-cosmonaut world, baby, right?
Well, that's right. Once we shut down the American Space Shuttle program, if we want to get to the International Space Station, the Soyuz is the only ticket in town.
And the Soyuz launches from where, and how different is it from the Space Shuttle?
Well, there are a couple of things. The Soyuz is a small craft. It has three seats. The shuttle has seven. The Soyuz launches from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan, and which is out in the middle, you know, purposely of nowhere. And the shuttle launches from Florida. And the shuttle gets delayed if there's a little bit of wind, if there's a cloud cover, if, you know, I mean, there are many, many reasons the shuttle can't launch. With the Soyuz, baby, when it's time to go, boom, it goes. It's as dependable as an AK-47 rifle.
Which is very, very dependable. And
it's Russian workmanship.
They even train at Star City, right?
That's exactly right. Our American astronauts go over to Star City, and they get trained in flying the Soyuz, coming down on the Soyuz, and living aboard the Russian part of the space station. They learn in Russian. They take tutorials. Their course materials are in Russian, though they get them translated. It is an immersion experience for our astronauts and staffers.
How different is the culture of the American astronaut program versus the Russian cosmonaut program? And we've got, you know, really two generations to look at here.
Well, they find, ultimately, that they've got a lot in common, but the two programs' orientation has been very different. The Russians emphasized long-duration space flight long before the Americans got around to it, and they really put people up there in space stations for a long time. They were going for endurance at a time when the American program was developing this sort of expedition, this sort of quick sortie shuttle orientation. And so we developed tremendous technical skills, but they developed survival skills.
Mm-hmm. Which are probably as important as the technical skills, thinking about the long missions that the U.S. at least has on the drawing board. Whether they can actually pull them off or not, that's another question.
And that's why the partnership is so very important. That's why Russia and the United States have fruitfully worked together over the last 15 years, because look what each side has gotten out of it.
And why hasn't there been a tremendous amount of attention paid to that? It's not as if we've read that story over and over again, that American astronauts have been living in Star City. And how many astronauts are we talking about over those 15 years?
Well, I keep writing the stories. Why aren't you reading them?
I have read these stories. I didn't realize it was for so long, 15 years.
Yes, this is the problem that America has taken, Americans, the American audience, if you will, has taken its eye off the space program in a big way. We've been doing amazing things. The original Shuttle Mir program, where we took astronauts up to the Mir space station in the mid-90s, it was a tremendous adventure, but people only heard about it when things went wrong. When a Progress vehicle collided with the Mir space station, and things looked pretty hairy for a while.
I think you wrote a story for the Times about how bad it smelled inside the Mir.
Apparently just awful.
So the International Space Station has learned some lessons from the Mir. What are they principally, and where do you go from here in terms of a permanent space base in near-Earth orbit?
Well, first of all, they learned a lot about creating and maintaining equipment that lasts, and in putting in the kind of safety procedures that mean you've got even more backup capability. So if something goes bad, you can repair it there, or have a spare on hand. And the space station is really well equipped for stuff like that. Even more important, but we've learned a lot. The American side has learned a tremendous amount about keeping an astronaut happy over a long duration flight. It is lonely, even if you've got other people around. What if you don't get along with them? There are things like the third quarter phenomenon where people's attention and enthusiasm starts to lag two-thirds of the way or three-quarters of the way, two-thirds of the way through a long mission. And then you just have to deal with all of these psychological issues.
Are Russians better at that than Americans?
Russians have had more practice.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also sort of a suck-it-up attitude. You know,
by the Russians.
By the Russians.
Really?
So on the
and
one
that's
hand...
that's so different from NASA?
NASA has developed a pretty supportive psychological regime to go with this. And
with the exception of certain women who wear diapers and ride on trips
that
across
was after
the country.
The flight.
I see. Last question, John. Space tourism. Why do the Russians do it, and has it been successful? There's a space tourist up on the ship right now.
Richard Garriott's up there right now. He paid $30 million. This came out of the cash-strapped Russian space program when they were taking money wherever they could. And so, you know, the first one spent probably about $20 million. The price has been rising. It's cash money. And the Russians like that.
That's right.
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't? Indeed. In fact, that's maybe the way out of this financial crisis, just to pay cash money for seats on spaceships. John Schwartz is a reporter for The New York Times, author of today's article in Science Times called In Russia, A Second Home for U.S. Astronauts. And now, very much here on Earth, Femi Yoke with the headlines.
Thank you, John. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Futures are up about 11% before the market opens in a minute or two. Investors seem bolstered by the new plan set out this morning by President Bush to provide banks with direct capital infusions, although the president did warn that the recovery won't be immediate.
It'll take time for our efforts to have their full impact, but the American people can have confidence about our long-term economic future. We have a strategy that is broad, that is flexible, and that is aimed at the root cause of our problem.
Two fires in the San Fernando Valley have combined to scorch more than 15 square miles. Santa Ana winds are fueling the huge wildfires near Los Angeles. The blaze has forced thousands to flee their homes, and one resident admits to being scared. And you can actually hear the wind noise in the background as she speaks.
It's my first time this happens. That was so close to a fire. Yes, I'm scared because my daughter and then my family, my puppies.
It's a little demonstration of the Santa Ana winds. They're going about 80 miles
an hour.
So what
do winds do? They blow?
They're brutal. They're dry and it's windy. I lived in L.A. for a long time.
And the winds are coming off the land, which is why they're so warm, and they actually do fuel the fires. If the wind is coming off the sea, you get a little moisture.
And that's the actual sound of the wind blowing?
It is.
So I should feel like I'm actually there.
Why would I even listen to you? Yeah, you're teasing me again. California's Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared a state of emergency. And finally, a U.S.-led coalition killed five militants in central Afghanistan today. One of its own members also died in a separate roadside bomb explosion.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. What's probably safe to say that 50 years from now, traders on Wall Street will be asking themselves, where were you then? Those crazy days in October of 2008. Dow Jones Industrial Average opened for just a couple of minutes. It's up about 350 points, similar about 3% rise instantaneously in the S&P 500. Another wild day on Wall Street. And the polls are open in America.
Mike in Palo Zero, Manville, New Jersey.
I made up my mind when McCain chose Palin, who else would he pick for other key positions in our government? Government's not bad. The people you put in government is bad. So that's when I made up my mind.
He's telling us the story of making up his mind in America's exit poll. You can be in America's exit poll by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. The polls are open all over America with early voting laws. Call us with your story of voting and making up your mind, Adore.
And there are polls that are trying to predict what people will do come Election Day. So far, those polls are showing Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama ahead of John McCain anywhere from 4 to 13 points. But with 3 weeks until Election Day, what do these polls, what do they really say about what people are thinking? Do they take racial views into account? Do they include young voters? We're turning now to pollster Ann Selzer, president of Selzer and Company, for her take. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how is it possible that there is this enormous spread from 4 to 13 points?
You know, if I were an ordinary voter, I would be very frustrated trying to parse out why these different polls would show so many different things. And the reality is polling has gotten more complicated, and pollsters use different methods. They define likely voters differently. They're taking a look at the electorate from different perspectives, and not all of them are very good at explaining to the reader or to the viewer what exactly it is are the assumptions that they're making. And some of those assumptions lead to a bigger margin for Barack Obama, and some of them lead to a smaller margin for Barack Obama. But virtually all of them, and I think you can sort of take some solace from this, all of them show the same finding, that is, Barack Obama in a lead.
Why is polling more complicated today than it's been in the past? I mean, you're still trying to get into the minds of people before they actually cast a ballot.
That's right, and it's always been tricky. I don't want anybody to think it's ever been a walk in the park. But this year, and it's become more increasingly difficult because there are segments of the population who are harder to reach. People worry a lot about what's happening with cell phones. Can pollsters reach them? Yes, in fact, they can reach them. They're not terribly cooperative when they are reached on cell phones. But are there pollsters who are leaving out a big demographic of younger people if they're just concentrating on landline phones? And the answer is you have to be cagey in your methodology. You have to recognize that that's a problem and find a way to account for it. And if you can account for the age difference between cell phone users and landline users, then the studies show that really you're in pretty good shape.
Polls have been notoriously bad at evaluating what young voters are going to do. I remember in 2004, the estimates were way off when, in fact, you had 2 to 3 million more young voters who actually did cast a ballot.
Well, I think part of the reason is that in any survey that we do, whether they're political or not, we typically undercount younger people. We also typically undercount African Americans. It's just kind of a demographic fact of life. They're harder to get on the phone. Maybe they're home less often. It's just more difficult to include them. And in this year, when the youth vote and the African American vote skew so heavily for Barack Obama, it's not a year where you want to make any mistakes.
And not only the African American vote, but racial attitudes. There's been much talk about how the polls can account for the so-called Bradley effect. Do you want to explain to us what that is and what evidence exists today that it's in play?
The Bradley effect was named after Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley, an African American, who was shown to be leading in the polls and then lost a very close election. And people came up with the theory that there were white voters who told a pollster on the phone that they were going to vote for Tom Bradley and then went into the voting booth and did not cast the vote for the white candidate instead. From my perspective, and I've done a lot of worrying on this topic, because we polled in Iowa and in Michigan and in Indiana, I just don't see the hard evidence for it. So it's actually rather controversial among pollsters as to whether it exists, and if it does, how might you go about measuring it? My theory is that it's less a matter of people lying to their pollster.
I think it's more a matter of a segment of voters kind of not terribly engaged in the election, therefore not showing up as a likely voter, but on election day, something leads them to say, I've got to go and vote. I've got to go and vote. So it's just a matter of having that vote undercounted before the election.
But, quickly, from the primary campaign, it would seem that you would be able to find voters who did this, who told a pollster one thing and then maybe didn't vote for Barack Obama in the primary. Is there any evidence from the many, many polls that were taken during the primary campaign?
Again, none that I've seen. And please keep in mind that while there was a large turnout in the primaries, it's nothing like the turnout in a general election. So it can take a very small swing among a few groups of people right at the very end in a heavily politicized time for there to be a difference between the polls and what happens on primary election day.
And final question. Give us your best advice when we're taking a look at these polls. What should we take away from them?
I would do my best to look at the detail to say what do they think a likely voter is, number one. Number two, have they done any adjusting to their sample according to age? Have they made it representative in some way?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that means going to the website and digging into the methodology, but because they're not really putting it out there. I think there are some sites. Pollster.com does a very nice job of helping you get more details, and I would just encourage voters to really dig as much as they possibly can tolerate the detail.
Do some digging. Ann Seltzer, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Ann Seltzer, president of Seltzer & Company. And now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got a few headlines for us. Femi.
Thanks, Adora. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Now we turn to Adora, who's got the latest on the markets for us. Adora.
The Dow opened 358 up so far, NASDAQ up a bit, and S&P up a bit.
Thank you very much. Probably in reaction to President Bush, who announced this morning the plans for the first chunk of the bailout plan. The government will buy $250 billion worth of equity shares in banks. The FDIC will also expand insurance to cover accounts that aid small businesses. Pepsi will eliminate 3,300 positions around the world, and this comes after an almost 10% drop in their third quarter profits. GM is also downsizing, and they're closing two plants, so that's 2,700 jobs that will be wiped out. And GM shares lost nearly half their value last week. They hit the lowest level since the 1940s. And North Korea will begin dismantling its nuclear facility again today, and this follows the country's removal from the terrorism blacklist in the US. That's your news.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And Femi Okeh, our compadre, is here because she had a story in the newscast that we learned about yesterday that was really, really amazing. It involved a Nashville musician who was going through brain surgery while he was playing the banjo. What's going on here, Femi?
Oh, just have a listen in. This is Eddie Adcock. And he's playing while the surgeons are working on his brain. Now, for the last 15 years, Eddie Adcock suffered from a tremor in his hand, and Eddie makes his living playing the banjo, so this was very bad news. But this August, Eddie had surgery at Nashville's Vanderbilt University. Eddie, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing, Simi?
I'm very well, thanks, Eddie. Why did you stay awake for the whole time you were having surgery?
Well, you have to stay awake during most brain surgeries, but I had to stay awake in order to have him guide the four electrodes on the end of the wire down through my brain. However, there's no feeling in the brain, so I didn't experience pain from that.
So they're operating on your brain. You're playing the banjo. How is your banjo playing changing as they're doing the operation?
Well, from the beginning of the operation, I could not play at all. My tremor had gotten so bad I couldn't play. At the end of the operation, I was playing normal.
That's really remarkable. Now, you're hooked up to a couple of pieces of equipment. So you've got a pacemaker and electrodes. Explain how that actually works.
Actually, it's called a generator in this case. and it sends a small amount of voltage to my brain. It's a wire that's it's planted in my chest. The wire runs up my neck and into the brain up in, on the top left side. So it's because it's right side motor skills. And it just puts in a program, I mean, a certain amount of electricity. And it has to be programmed to get it to work exactly right. So,
Eddie, did they make you sterilize your banjo?
No, that was a funny thing. I never had to sterilize anything. They were very careful themselves not to touch it, you know, or do anything like that. But I never sterilized it. I laid it on my chest, and they pushed the bed into the operating room. And watching out for the neck of the banjo, I had my little small practice Deering banjo. So it wasn't really my regular big banjo. It would have been really hard to do.
You know, Eddie, I'm not even going to ask you if it worked. You've pretty much cleared that up, and we're going to end with some of your music. I'm so glad it worked out for you, and we're going to post the video of your operation on our website so everybody can see it for themselves. This is Eddie Adcock playing the banjo with the help of his generator. Take it away, Eddie.
So that's him playing after the surgery.
After the surgery.
It's a miracle.
And they drilled a hole in his head, and he played while they were drilling, and they put the electrodes in and saying, is it getting better, Eddie? Is it getting better, Eddie? It was an amazing piece of video. I'm so glad we tracked Eddie down, because it was really good to talk to him this morning.
It's always shocking when you hear people who have gone through this operation say it doesn't hurt. Because watching it, you would think it would be excruciating. But here he was, playing.
Go, Eddie.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 14th, and John, so far the markets seem to be embracing the details that we heard from President Bush this morning and on $250 billion that the Treasury plans on injecting into the banking system.
Would we call this confidence or would we call it seizure activity? On
Anyway, whatever you call it, so far the Dow is up about 2%, the NASDAQ is flat, and the S&P is up about 2.5%.
And we have headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much. Coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. President Bush announced plans for distribution of the first chunk of the bailout plan. The government will buy $250 billion worth of equity shares in banks. Markets are responding positively to the news. And as Adora and John just gave you the latest, the Dow's up around about 4%. The economist Paul Krugman has won the Nobel Prize for economics, excuse me. And the New York Times columnist has been reacting to news of the bailout.
Well, it is what the doctor ordered. It's what a lot of economists had been calling for when Britain did this last week, announced a similar plan. Many of us cheered, saying that's the way to go. These are crazy and scary times, but this is our best shot at this point, so it's the right thing.
And that's Paul Krugman, who has won the Nobel Prize for economics, excuse me. Powerful wildfires are roaring through Southern California. Nearly 1,300 acres have been destroyed. More than 2,000 firefighters are working to combat the blaze, which is being fueled by Santa Ana winds. A roadside blast in Afghanistan killed three NATO soldiers in East Afghanistan early this morning. Defense Secretary Robert Gates called for an increase of NATO soldiers to the country last week. And in baseball, the Tampa Bay Rays won 9-1 to take a one-game lead over Boston in the ALCS. And in the National League, the Phillies won 7-5 against the Dodgers, placing them within one game of going on to the World Series.
The awesome Phillies. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Well, the markets are reacting very, very positively, very exuberantly to the steps, the coordinated steps by the U.S. government and governments in Germany, Italy, and the U.K. to actually take equity stakes in the banking system. We wanted to get a perspective not of a market trader or of someone buying and selling stock, but the perspective of someone who maybe is an unrepentant socialist, an absolute leftist, someone who believes that socialism is, in fact, the economic orthodoxy. What do they think of this rescue plan? So we contacted the former mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. He's known as Red Ken. He's well known as a socialist and a leftist on economic issues. They say capital injection, Mr. Livingstone. What do you call it?
Well, it's a bailout for the banking system. And given the situation we're in, I can understand that British government and most of the European governments, and to a degree even George Bush, are going down this road. My own slight preference would be actually to let each bank fail and then nationalise them without cost. That's what the British government did with the Northern Rock Bank. And part of the problem at the moment is we're all seeing this as though somehow bankers have done something wrong. The reality is this economic upheaval is because the dollar is overvalued by about 30%. So it doesn't matter what you do with individual banks. Anybody that's holding assets in dollars is facing a pretty catastrophic loss. And therefore, until you get the American dollar reflecting the real value of the current situation, we're going to carry on having these sort of upheavals.
So personally, is this a kind of I told you so moment for the rest of the world economy, or is it something that's structural that you believe is kind of inevitable? You mentioned the dollar, but are there other issues in the global economy that make this unavoidable?
President Carter, 30 years ago, told the American people they were living beyond their means, they had to invest more, they had to save more, and he was thrown out. And then you had President Reagan in America, Mrs. Thatcher in Britain saying deregulate the banks and so on. So we spent 25 years borrowing, whilst India and China have grown, they're investing, they're saving. And what we're going through is a big correction. There's a shift of power here from Europe and America to India and China and the rest of Asia. And this just simply reflects the change of global power. Well, I'm part of that post-war generation. I grew up in a world run by Europe and America. That world's coming to a close, and we're all going to have to work a lot harder, save a bit more, invest a bit more.
But Ken Livingstone, if that is really the case, how come the entire world is flocking to U.S. Treasury bonds as a place to park their money at the very moment you say this power shift is causing the sort of extinction of American economic supremacy?
Basically, the very reasonable nature of the Chinese communist leadership, they recognize that if they didn't carry on buying American bonds and dollars, you'd have something like the Great Depression again. So they're prepared to prop up the American economy for a period of time and ease this shift of power. Also, if you actually think of the old Soviet Union, their broad view was we'll match America bomb by bomb and nuclear missile by nuclear missile, sub by sub. The Chinese have realized it's much simpler. You just prop up your opponent's currency, and they're not in a position where they can attack you.
Well, if China is driving this, what if they just chose, instead of investing in dollars, investing in, say, Kiwis or in McDonald's franchises in New Guinea? Would the entire American economy fall to pieces?
Well, if the Chinese communist leadership decided tomorrow, no more American purchases, then yes, you'd be heading to a Great Depression. But what's striking about the Chinese communist leadership, they're prepared to play a long game, they think, in terms of a generation, 30, 40 years, and easing this. They clearly see catastrophic global economic recession would damage them as well. So they're prepared to prop up America while it gratefully and graciously declines.
So does it give you some sort of economic security, knowing that the Chinese communists are running the show here as a, socialist yourself?
My 8 years as mayor, I did everything possible to attract Indian and Chinese investment to London. So we rebalanced our economy so it wasn't so dependent on the United States of America. all my life, when America had a recession, we had something worse. Right? Now we're in a position where just the global economy is more diverse. That's the world we're all going to live in. I mean, the bad news for people in Europe and America is we have to consume a little less, invest a little more, train a little harder, because there are new kids on the block, and they're doing better than we are.
Are the Chinese insulated from a global recession if the entire system should tank?
Well, no, they're not insulated, but you've still got over half the Chinese population living on the land. And there, therefore, is 30 or 40 years more growth in China as people leave the land to come to the cities and be more economically productive, a bit like America did in the last century and Europe did in the last century. So they're not insulated, but they're in a position where they've still got... I mean, in the same way that the 20th century was an American century because America invested more than all its rivals. And then by the end of the century, that was no longer the case. Germany, Japan, and now China, and India and Vietnam, all investing more. So power will continue to shift. Now, this isn't the end of the world. If you go back before the discovery of America by the Europeans and before slavery and before colonialism, I mean, broadly economic wealth in the world reflected the size of your population. We're going back to that. So if you come back in 25 years, China will be the leading world economy. America will still be number two. But close behind, perhaps even equal, will be India. And then there'll be Europe. So it's just we've lived in a world for 60 years where America was top dog, could set the agenda and determine the way the world would be. That world's coming to a close. And as long as America can elect politicians who understand that and start to redirect the American economy to invest a bit more, train its workforce a bit better, we'll be fine. The real worry would be a sort of Sarah Palin character coming to the presidency who just starts lashing out and thinking this is unfair. China's winning because it's working harder.
All right, well, Ken Livingston, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ken Livingston, former mayor of London and referred to as Red Ken for the leftist views on the blog he publishes, the Socialist Economic Bulletin, .blogspot.com. Ken Livingston, thanks so much.
And he certainly gives us a few things to think about.
Couldn't resist taking a shot at Palin, though. I love that.
I know. We're always on at The Takeaway, want to remind you. And today we're talking all day about the economy. You guessed it.
I disagree with Speaker Pelosi, who says we have to tighten our belt. How more can we tighten? I get $700 a month for Social Security retirement. The people in Wall Street, they're not tightening their belt. Who's tightening the belt? Not the Congress people, not the president. It's us people. We're already tight. What more can we tighten?
Call us with your tightening story, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
And here's your takeaway.
When it's time to go, boom, it goes. It's as dependable as an AK-47 rifle.
It's John Schwartz, reporter for The New York Times, talking about the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. Very reliable spacecraft. It is, yes, indeed. As best as AK-47. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.